From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Throughout the week, people have been trying to put into perspective the latest revelation of government secrets. Because something like this has happened before, it seems like there's a pattern to the story where the leaker is seen as a hero or a traitor. And then there's the usual hand-wringing about privacy and free speech. But if you want some context for the story, you should see Alex Gibney's latest documentary called We Steal Secrets. Gibney's film is about the Army private Bradley Manning, who turned over thousands of classified documents to the website WikiLeaks. It's also a profile of the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange. Gibney's film shows how these stories are about the broad questions, like what is secret or what is public, but they're also about human beings, which complicates things. Today in the program, Gibney will join us to talk about his film after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The big news story of the week, of course, is the latest revelation of government secrets, this time by the former CIA technician Edward Snowden. Snowden divulged classified details about the extensive data collection programs in the National Security Agency. It wasn't so long ago that we went through a story like this, when the Army private Bradley Manning was arrested for releasing thousands of classified documents to the website WikiLeaks. Manning's trial began this week, and of course there are important differences between Manning and Snowden, but it seems as though the same kinds of questions are being raised, influenced by the same kinds of forces. This is why Alex Gibney's film about the WikiLeaks revelations may offer some of the clearest perspective to the story. Gibney's film works through the questions of secrecy and power in the internet era, or transparency and free expression, but he also reveals how these stories take on human dimensions, influenced by people with their own personal or political motivations. The film is called We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, and today in the program, Alex Gibney is joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join us as well. If you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Alex Gibney is the Oscar, Emmy, and Grammy Award-winning director of numerous documentary films, including Taxi to the Dark Side, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, and Mea Maxima Culpa. We Steal Secrets premiered at Sundance this year, and it's opening this weekend in Salt Lake City at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Alex Gibney is joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Alex Gibney, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Good to be here. Or here, or there.
Or there.
On the air with you.
Right, good. What did you think this film was going to be about when you first started? I mean, did you understand just how complicated it was going to get when you started folding in the human elements of all of this?
No, I didn't understand that at all. I thought it was going to be a relatively simple David and Goliath story about Julian Assange versus the U.S. national security state. And I thought it was also about a new technology, a leaking machine. And I was confounded, really. It turned out to be much more complicated than that.
It seems like this – so would you say that in some ways the essence of the film is about that human element, that, as you say, it wasn't about the machine, it was about the way human beings again, that human element, when you throw that into the mix?
I think it's about the intersection between human beings and machines, in a way, or human beings and the internet. I think that's really one of the key aspects of the film. It's how we're all changing as a result of the internet, in a way, and how, you know, this whole issue of secrets has become radically shifted because of that. Changes in technology, but at the same time, fundamental human issues and interactions and motivations still stay the same in some ways, so that you can't really understand these technological shifts without continuing to reckon with what moves us as people.
Are you I'm sure it's too early to start working through the particulars of Edward Snowden's story, but are you keeping in mind the human aspect when you start seeing the way the story plays out?
I am.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know a lot about him yet, but I'm certainly keeping the human aspect in mind, and it appears to be a pretty interesting story. And there are a lot of interesting parallels between his story and the story of Bradley Manning. And indeed, I think he actually studied, I don't know this for sure because I haven't spoken to him, but based on what we know and the statements that he's come out with, I think he studied the WikiLeaks story pretty extensively and made certain decisions based on that study.
Well, we'll get to that as we go, but it seems like one of the lessons he may have learned, if in fact he did look at that story, was that maybe it wasn't such a good idea to just let everything go, to maybe find compartments for it. Do you think that's one of the things he may have figured out with the Bradley
Manning story? He explicitly
said
that. Yeah. He explicitly said that one of the things that he wanted to do was to only leak documents that he himself had looked at. I mean, Bradley Manning did do some culling too, but obviously he didn't look at every document that he leaked. But according to Snowden, he did. And it was very much of a conscious decision to only do that. He also said that, you know, data came across his desk that might have been terribly damaging to the United States and to individuals, like the names of CIA agents or operatives. And he didn't release those, at least so far as we know. So, you know, he was making a very conscious decision about what kinds of materials to release.
Do you remember what was your first impression, your initial sense of Julian Assange when you first learned about him?
I read a long article in The New Yorker magazine by Rafi Khachaturian, a wonderful article really, that focused on Assange's time in Iceland and the preparation for the collateral murder video, which was the video of the Apache gunship attack in Iraq that ultimately resulted in the pilots killing two Reuters reporters. And Assange seemed like a terribly romantic figure from the centrifuge. He had grown up on a small island off the coast of Queensland in Australia called Magnetic Island, so named because Captain Cook claimed that when he went by the island, it fouled his compasses. So I thought, wow, what a romantic and spectacular beginning for a man who would foul the compasses of the United States government. So, you know, I found him to be a terribly compelling and romantic figure. A guy who wanted to right wrongs by exposing secrets seemed pretty compelling to me.
Let me play.
And I had seen, you know, I had seen some of the, I had actually before Assange became wildly famous, I had seen some of the, I'd seen the collateral murder video on the site, and I was terribly impressed. I thought that this is very interesting that now we have a kind of site that's going to give us access to stuff that the government doesn't want us to see, but we should see.
Yeah. Let me play a clip from your film. The question early on in the film is put to Julian Assange, what is it that drives you? And I want to talk about his answer, which I think is interesting. Here it is from the film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks.
What drives you?
Well, I like being creative. I mean, I've been an inventor or designing systems and processes for a long time. I also like defending victims. And I'm a combative person, so I like crushing bastards. And so this sort of profession combines all those three things. So it is deeply, personally, deeply satisfying to me.
But is crushing bastards in its own right a just cause?
It depends on the bastard.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there's also an interview. You talk with the filmmaker Mark Davis, who has interviewed Assange, knows him. Talks about, and you mentioned being caught up in Melbourne in the 1990s. He was caught up in the early days of the internet revolution and how he was motivated by the intellectual challenge of it. So this idea of creativity and the intellectual challenge seems to be one of the keys. Do you think you understand what motivates Julian Assange a little better?
I think so. I think he is motivated by anger. Yeah. I mean, there is a kind of deep-seated anger toward what he sees as the great enemies, the big powers, these kind of inchoate forces that are governments and big corporations. And that sticks in his craw, and it makes him angry, and it motivates him. I think he's motivated in great part by anger.
There's this story you tell. He gets caught up in this international sting. Hackers who had broken into the U.S. military online security, and he was caught, and he was charged. And he gets a fairly lenient sentence. I mean, he pleads guilty and is sentenced to, I think it's 3 years in probation. But it seems like the lesson he took from that was maybe that he probably regretted pleading guilty, but also that he had all this information at the time, didn't know quite what to do with it. And now 20 years later, if we fast forward, and he's got all this information, and now he knows what to do with it. That, I mean, he was in some way motivated by that sense of, I kind of blew it in the past, and now I'm going to do something right.
Well, I think in the past he was motivated also by exploration. There was a kind of giddy adolescent pleasure, you know, derived by a lot of hackers by exploring places that you're not supposed to be able to go.
Right.
And not allowed to see. As a slightly older man, he saw a much greater political value, or maybe even moral value, to understanding those secrets, to exploring that territory. And this time, I think he also recognized that it wasn't enough to sort of see the data. He had to know a little bit more about what it was that he was accessing. Mm-hmm. These secret worlds sometimes need a translator. And for that, he went to the mainstream press, you know, to try to help him understand these logs that ultimately showed up on his website, these Afghan war logs that were, you know, produced by the U.S. Army, and the Iraq war logs, full of a lot of strange acronyms that would have been very hard to penetrate without the help of experts.
I wonder, you mentioned in the film the effect that 9/11, of course, had on all of this, how the amount of classified documents has increased, I think, from 8 to 76 million. It's probably growing exponentially as we speak. How the government began to intercept phone calls and emails at a rate of, I can't remember the astounding rate. What was it, Alex?
60,000 a second.
A second. Did that surprise you, just how vulnerable we all are?
Yes. I mean, it surprised me that what's staggering now in the period of the internet is not only how vulnerable we are, but also the mass of data that passes in front of us all the time. I mean, one of the big problems that the NSA has had for a long time is actually digesting all of this material. No, I think a lot of us in the United States and also in Europe are properly upset with the revelations that they're actually collecting all this material. But I think that it's, you know, that's what made the Bradley Manning leaks so powerful, because suddenly, you know, instead of doing what Daniel Ellsberg did, which is to have to take weeks in front of a Xerox machine, suddenly, you know, with a flick of a button, you could download massive amounts of material onto a memory stick. So that was really – so the amount of information that we see before us is really – what's changed. It's hard to penetrate.
Mm. Let's talk about Bradley Manning. As a character in the film, he's only revealed to us through the letters that he types into a computer. When did this come to you as a kind of as a conceit, as an idea? Because it's strangely compelling, strangely intimate as a form.
I mean, frankly, we were terrified as filmmakers to present somebody, a main character. He turns out to be a main character in the film, purely through text. I mean, you hear his voice very briefly in a on a voicemail message.
Right.
Otherwise, Bradley Manning presents himself purely through text. And so we wondered, would this be possible? I mean, we have to get an actor to read it. But it seemed to me that the more poignant and important way of presenting him was precisely through that text. I mean, you know, people communicate via chat, iChat, you know, text all the time now. Mm. People hook up and break up via text. You know, it's become – we've discovered a new form of communication. It's not like people didn't write to each other before. But sometimes it's odd where you feel this sense of both power and isolation as you're typing something into a computer that's unmediated by – having to adjust for the expression of somebody sitting across the table from you and you send them out a message. And in some ways, I think we find it more comfortable. I know a lot of, you know, folks in my shop, particularly younger folks, you know, have a harder time reaching out and calling people on the phone. They much rather send them an email or a text. There's something intriguing about that, and it turns out to be very intimate and revealing. So we went for it all the way. You only know Bradley Manning through his texts, through his chats, through this that he made with this gray hat hacker, Adrian Lamo, who, after all, turned out to be the guy who turned him in.
Yeah. Another great character, by the way, and another, I have to say, really powerful, poignant story, which I want to work toward. But this is interesting. I'm not sure what to do in some ways. It's interesting. On one hand, you have Bradley Manning, who has extraordinary access, who has these incredible sort of computer skills. He has this sophistication for it. But then on the other hand, he's this misfit kid, you know, grows up in Oklahoma, a science fair buff, computer nerd. And then, of course, you raise these big questions about his gender identity. And he's working out these struggles. And in some ways, it's not just his concern about the secrets that he's seeing and wanting to disclose them, but also he's reaching out because he has this gender identity question, and it's such an interesting sort of combination. Talk about how you wanted to sort of take on this question, because this is a very revealing part about who Bradley Manning is and his motivation, I think.
That's true. And actually, it's very revealing about Bradley Manning because we know through these chats with Adrian Lamo that he was terribly interested in this.
Yeah.
I didn't go, you know, burrowing deep into the chats. It's all over the chats. You know, he reached out, I think, to Adrian Lamo in part because he knew he was a hacker. He knew he was interested in WikiLeaks, and he knew he was bisexual. And there were a lot of issues that Bradley Manning wanted to talk about. So and it is true that he was going through a kind of emotional trauma while he was in Iraq for a whole lot of reasons having to do with his own sexual identity and with being a gay man in an army during the time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And he wasn't really army material in the classic sense. You know, he was small. He was not rah-rah. He was effeminate. And I think that, you know, all of that plays into the story. The army tried to make that the story. They tried to suggest that Manning leaks because he's a misfit. I don't think that's why he leaked, but it ends up being a key clue in the mystery of why he was discovered. After all, you know, to hear WikiLeaks promotional materials tell us, you know, it was the perfect machine. All you have to do is drop these materials into the machine and then, you know, your identity will never be discovered. Well, his identity was discovered because he needed to reach out to somebody to talk about what it was that he did and the kind of pain and anguish he was going through. It turns out that the human connection was very important. Mm. I also think that, you know, in stories like this, you have to embrace the contradictions.
Yes.
You know, recently, Jeffrey Toobin has mocked Edward Snowden, for example, for being a narcissist, as if you can't be, you know, self-interested and do something good all at the same time. You know, you have to embrace the contradictions of everyday life. And in Bradley Manning, you know, it's fair to say that if you're in the military and you looked at the number of explosive emotional moments that he had, you know, you have to wonder whether that's a guy that you want keeping secrets. At the same time, that doesn't mean that his motivations weren't at the same time political. So it's all part of a very interesting story. And frankly, the army needed him. You know, they tried to flush him out of the system. His immediate supervisor recommended that he not deploy to Iraq. But the army desperately needed him because I suspect, like Snowden, though we don't know as much about him yet, because he was so good with computers. He was smart. He was super smart. And they needed people like him in Iraq to deal with the massive amounts of data that were coming across people's computers.
Well, this is, I think, another powerful part of the film is, and we see the same kinds, and we'll get to this, but the same kind of complicated personal life when we talk about Julian Assange. And it seems like the reaction that you get from people, and this is a good part of what the film is about also, we're looking for them to be one-dimensional.
Yes.
We're looking for them to have a certain sort of political motivation or to be pure in some way. But I think that's in many ways a big takeaway from the film is, sorry, that doesn't happen. People aren't that way.
Right. Why? Because somebody performs a heroic act or a powerful political act, why should we expect them to be perfect people or perfect heroes? They're not that way. And it may be that they do other things that are not only imperfect but wrong. And we should be prepared to call them on that. Why should we begin to make excuses for people just because they did something that at a certain moment in time was quite powerful and important. You know, it goes back to this idea of embracing the contradictions of everyday life. You know, I think we desperately want heroes because, you know, in a life that's so complicated, we want to make things simple. But it turns out they're not so simple.
Alex Gibney is with us. His latest film is called We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. It's showing here in Salt Lake City starting on Friday at the Broadway Center Cinemas. You can find out more about that on our website or where it might be showing in your area, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the consequences of revealing government secrets. There's, of course, the most recent revelation about the collection of private internet and telephone data, and then, of course, the thousands of documents released by Army Private Bradley Manning. The filmmaker Alex Gibney has produced a film that may offer the most clear-headed assessment of these issues. Gibney says this is not just about the conflict between free speech and security, and it's not just about a website or a machine. It's about humans. The film is called We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, and it's opening at the Broadway Center Cinemas in Salt Lake this weekend. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Alex Gibney is joining us from a studio in New York City. What's intriguing about the film also is how these things have these layers of ethical complications, that it's not just about the simple motive of shedding light on government secrets. I mean, there are human lives involved in various ways. And let's talk about Bradley Manning's life. When Manning is arrested, the spotlight then turns to Julian Assange. As you point out in the film, there was more information that Assange had that he hadn't yet published. And so there's this big question now, because everyone knows, okay, even though Assange wasn't saying out and out, I got this from Bradley Manning, it was pretty clear. And so the question is, would WikiLeaks put Bradley Manning in greater jeopardy by continuing to release his materials? And it's a big ethical question. And this is when we start to wonder about the motivation. Talk about that part, the ethical questions, the way it starts to layer now.
Sure. The question is, you know, once he's been arrested, do you possibly compound his jeopardy by continuing to release more materials that might be seen as more damaging, that might put him in greater legal jeopardy? That's a big question. Yet at the same time, you have the other ethical issue, which is Bradley Manning leaked these materials so that they would see the light of day. In other words, they go to WikiLeaks so that, you know, as Julian Assange puts it in the film, that our sources, you know, have for their materials maximum impact. Now, it may have been self-serving for Julian Assange to decide that that was the more important course, but I don't think it was necessarily wrong. I think to some extent Manning did leak materials, you know, for that purpose. So but it wasn't that I think Julian was conflicted. I think Daniel Domscheit-Berg, the guy who was working with him, was also conflicted. I think he was of the opinion that they should have been more cautious, that they should have either waited or perhaps not release more materials. I think Julian felt, after pausing a moment to wonder, full speed ahead, that he gave us these materials to leak. We're going to publish them.
I want to play another clip from the film. This is the Guardian, the newspaper, The Guardian, sets up this this operation with these key reporters from The New York Times and Der Spiegel. These are journalists who, as you say in the film, understand the arcane language of this massive leak of information. But these reporters also understand the implications of this information, because there is information in here, of course, that if revealed, possibly could get people hurt or possibly even killed. And this is really where the story in the film, it seems to me anyway, starts to take a turn. They're preparing for the publication of this information, and The Guardian has these reporters together, and they're starting to talk about these moral problems. This is where Nick Davis comes into play. I think in some way, Alex Gibney, Nick Davis, for me anyway, was kind of the voice of reason in some way. He was skeptical on both sides of the issue. I mean, he was really, I have to say, a very powerful voice to include in the story.
Well, and he's also very much, in some ways, very much a defender of Julian Assange.
Right.
Julian Assange may not see it that way, but I think, you know, there are aspects of Julian Assange that Nick Davis very much admires.
Yeah.
But then he feels he has this other side. So I found him a very even-handed reporter of this whole story. And also he was the guy who went to see Assange and persuaded him to come into The Guardian. I mean, Assange will say that it was all his idea.
Right.
I'm not sure that's true. I think that Nick Davis has a great deal of responsibility for bringing Julian into this group of reporters and seeking some political cover, which I think he could have had if things hadn't gone so wrong.
During the 4 or 5 weeks when the reporters were working on the Afghan war logs, all of us became concerned that there was material in there which, if published, could get people hurt on the ground in Afghanistan. This particularly related to ordinary Afghan civilians who, in one operation or incident or another, had given information to coalition forces, and that was recorded in there in such a way that those civilians were identifiable. I raised this with Julian, and he said, if an Afghan civilian helps coalition forces, he deserves to die. And he went on to explain that they have the status of a collaborator, an informer. Now,
are you sure about that? That's definitely what
I have absolutely no doubt about it at all. This was just me and him talking through the detail of how we handle this. And this problem, potential problem, had already come up. A, it's a moral problem. We are not here to publish material that gets people killed. B, if you publish information which really does get people hurt, or could conceivably get people hurt, you lose your political immunity. You're terribly vulnerable to the most obvious propaganda attack which is waiting for us in the wings, that you are helping the bad guys.
This is a big conflict in the film. Nick is trying to sort of temper the way the information comes out, not just to protect lives, but, as he says, he's trying to preserve Assange's and probably his own, you know, political authority, moral authority. But Assange's ethic for just getting information out is really powerful, and there's that conflict.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting, this idea of moral authority or the moral high ground, because if you think about leaks, the whole aspect of leaks, there is a moral question here. I mean, strictly speaking, it's illegal to leak. And yet we broadly accept the idea that it will happen and that reporters should go after the leaks, even though the government is meant to prevent them.
Right.
And we recognize this internal conflict because we think that there is actually a kind of moral issue here, that perhaps at some moment in time the government or a corporation will abuse its power, and it's important to reveal how that's being done. It's a kind of pressure valve. But in order to do that and do it right in a way that you're perceived as being on the side of righteousness, you have to have the moral high ground. And I think part of what Nick Davis was saying is you can't expose yourself to the political counterattack of saying that you're reckless with human beings. In other words, that you've released stuff that could get people hurt. Julian Assange and some of his supporters have said, well, nobody did get hurt. And I think that's true. But that doesn't mean that people weren't put at risk. They were. And I think Julian, who was a transparency radical, mm-hmm. really hadn't reckoned with this properly. And he was dismissing these concerns, sometimes in ways that I think were sort of sarcastic talking points. That's what I suspect he was saying to Nick. But I think he really didn't want to reckon with those concerns. He felt that you just release the material, period. But I think in this period, and this is where Mark Davis, the Australian filmmaker who was following Julian at this time, recognized that in his private moments, because Julian almost never allows himself to show weakness, but in his private moments that he was beginning to question. And so there was this weird moment with the release of the Afghan war logs where 15,000 of those war logs were held back by WikiLeaks. And there was a last-minute attempt to try to redact more names, but unsuccessfully. So a number of names were released in the WikiLeaks batch, though in the materials released by the journalistic organizations, all the names were properly redacted.
But here's the absurd turn to that story. Of course, Assange, through the New York Times, asks the Defense Department to help do these redactions.
Well, it's even more absurd because Julian Assange used to mock the New York Times for always going to the Pentagon and asking for permission or not even asking for permission, for consulting with them about what should and should not be leaked. He mocked the New York Times for doing that. And then he tried to take the high ground by saying, well, we gave the Pentagon an opportunity to do the redactions. It was it was kind of absurd. Mm. You could see that Julian was desperately searching for a moment. And also he claimed at the time that he had a harm minimization program at WikiLeaks, as if, you know, he had this thoroughgoing and very rigorous computer program to, you know, to edit out all the names. He had nothing of the kind. It was something he invented on the spot to pretend to people that they had this program. It was a program where he basically called up a few people and said, please help, redact. What's interesting, though, is that Julian does learn. I mean, by the time of the release of the Iraq war logs, actually, he worked with James Ball and some people from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism to come up with a very thoroughgoing and very disciplined computer program to actually search through the war logs and to squeeze out all names which might put people at risk. So they did learn. But it's too bad that Julian didn't have the ability to be more cautious and also to be a little bit less self-regarding.
Well, I think that's an important part of the film because, as Mark Davis points out, look, Assange does care about human life, even though he may sound provocative. But
that's right.
He didn't have the resources to deal with the information or really much in the way of support structure. And this is where you kind of feel for Julian Assange and you get a sense of the scope of WikiLeaks, which I think the journalist Gavin McFadden sort of describes as – I mean, you put the question to Gavin McFadden. He's a journalist. Is it like Apple or one of these big corporations? And he laughs and he says it's a corner gas station with some very bright attendants, which gives you a sense of the scope, really, the scale of WikiLeaks.
That's right. I mean, Julian always likes to describe it as an organization, as if, you know, there's a human resources department and there's a bill paying department and accounts receivable and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's a few people that he manages to persuade to be volunteers. It's tiny. And it was never really more than that. You know, as he describes it, it sort of reminded me of an old friend of mine who, when he was starting up a business, you know, it was just him in his office. But if you called the number for his new business, you know, it would say, for accounts receivable, dial 9.
Right.
You know, and everyone took it to the same place, the same answering machine. That's a little bit what WikiLeaks was like. And because they were such a small fledgling organization, people should have given them some slack. But I also think that Julian sadly should have been far more cautious than he was, because that big mistake, of not properly redacting those documents, allowed the Pentagon to assume the moral high ground. Even though, you know, they were saying that Julian Assange had blood on his hands, which, if you think about it, is a ridiculous statement considering the blood that was being shed in Iraq and Afghanistan. But nevertheless, it seemed that Julian Assange was being irresponsible. And so they managed to carve him out from this alliance with the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and The Guardian, and to basically say he's the problem, that kooky white-haired Australian. He's the problem, never mind these other people, because certainly the Obama administration did not want to pick a fight with the New York Times.
Yeah. Well, here's that point made in the film by Nick Davis.
I do not know whether anybody subsequently did get hurt. The fact that the material was there and identifiable as potentially dangerous did the political damage. When the material was first published, the world was indeed talking about civilian casualties in Afghanistan and about the existence of a squad that was going out and killing Taliban. But the White House managed the news, and the story became WikiLeaks has got blood on their hands.
From the film We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks, the filmmaker Alex Gibney is joining us. The film begins in Salt Lake City, opens on Friday at the Broadway Center Cinemas. You can find out the details on our website. RadioWest.KUER.org will give you details about that. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with filmmaker Alex Gibney. We're talking about his latest film, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. It's opening in Utah on Friday. You can find out details about that and where it is in other locations on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Gibney's joining us from a studio in New York City. I want to talk about Adrian Lamo, because he seems to reflect, I think, kind of the human conundrum and the way people take sides and get demonized. And talk about him, if you would. He's a hacker. He's kind of an odd fellow. I think he has Asperger's or something like that. But he is, I don't know, I was really taken by his storyline in the film.
Kevin Paulson, who used Lamo as a source for some time, Kevin Paulson, editor at Wired magazine, yeah, you know, talks about Lamo. He said he lives his life as if he were in his own novel, and every novelist likes to be read. And there's something about Lamo that wants to involve himself in the story, sometimes in ways that are unpredictable and hard to navigate or understand. I mean, I think he imagined himself to be a great patriot, and yet we know from his past that he was hardly a kind of rock-ribbed patriot. He lies to Manning.
Yeah.
You know, he says everything that you say will be held in the greatest confidence. And of course it's not. He's mining him for data. He's planning to leak Manning's logs to the government, yeah, in effect. He's leaking from the other side. So he occupies this very peculiar position. At the same time, he says he thought he needed to do this from a sense of patriotism, that this was a wholesale leak that could get a lot of people hurt. And I think he believed that to some extent. So you have these very conflicting, I mean, he tries to cast it as a hacker would in the context of the Kobayashi Maru, right, episode of Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody has to pass a test for a moment in which there is no possibly good decision, and we show a clip from Star Trek as a result.
Yeah. So no win,
a no win situation. That's, yeah, right. And so Adrian Lamo felt he was in a no win situation. He had to, in his words, had to betray Bradley Manning's trust in order to do something for the good of the country.
I didn't know what to make of him. I didn't know if I believed him. I mean, on one hand, you know, you have this kid leaking information which could cost lives, so I guess he's weighing that in the balance. On the other hand, you have this kid who's vulnerable and is reaching out to someone, looking for help, looking for a connection. He feels isolated. So I feel like, oh, is he really helping the country? Is he, really betraying him? I was surprised at how emotional Adrian Lamo gets about all of this. The other thing that was interesting, I think, Alex Gibney, is how in some ways people who are complicated get demonized in this process because, you know, he's pretty hated by a lot of people at this point.
He is. And I found it there's a very sort of poignant moment in the film where somebody at a computer conference says, "You should be sent to Guantanamo."
Yeah.
I thought, what an odd comment at a computer conference, you know, Guantanamo, which for most human rights activists is the epitome of the end of the rule of law, that now, you know, that should be a just punishment from Lamo, that we would send him or they would send him to Guantanamo. And Lamo winces. At the same time, you know, I don't know what to make of Lamo either. He doesn't seem kind of like the beacon of sincerity. It seems like he's playing a double, triple, or quadruple game. There are so many bank shots to the Adrian Lamo character that you're not quite sure what to make of him, except that somehow he wants to involve himself in the story. And he becomes, a double or a triple agent. And one of the agencies he's working for is clearly Adrian Lamo, because whatever happens out of this story, he did become fabulously famous, and some would say infamous and much reviled, but nevertheless, famous.
Here's Adrian Lamo from the film We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks.
I care more about Bradley than many of his supporters do. We had a chance to be friends, however briefly, and he opened up in a lot of ways about his life
his personal life, and he did it in a way that someone only would, someone they felt they could trust. And I had to betray that trust for the sake of all of the people that he put in danger. And I wish to hell that it had never happened.
The story in your film turns again when the charges of sexual abuse emerge for Julian Assange. I'm wondering, what did you learn about this part of the story? I mean, his supporters, of course, say it's politically motivated, that he's being smeared. And then they go ahead and start smearing the women who are making these allegations. I mean, it's so
right.
Such an odd part of the story.
That's right. That's right. It's very interesting because, you know, when I first approached the story, I more or less assumed that this was part of some kind of political smear. That Assange had been caught in some kind of clever trap, possibly set by the CIA. And I investigated it pretty thoroughly, and I went to Sweden a number of times. And, you know, I became convinced that this was really just a personal matter, that it was something that just got completely out of hand. I mean, he slept with two women. They both wanted him to use a condom. In one way or another, he foiled those desires. That is, and so they came to him and wanted him to take an HIV test, but he refused. And then they went to the police in order to force him to take an HIV test, and the police took matters into their own hands and decided to bring an investigation against him for possible minor rape and other charges. So that's what I discovered. But then the interesting aspect is what Assange makes of it. Yeah. You know, all the people inside, or many of the people inside WikiLeaks at the time, were begging him, don't make this about WikiLeaks.
Right.
Just go and deal with it, you know, on your own, and then just say, look, I'm taking some time to deal with this matter, and then I'll come back. But it has got nothing to do with WikiLeaks. He, in fact, did just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He makes it a part of WikiLeaks so that then, you know, he says he leaves all sorts of little clues, as Nick Davis says. He starts the little ball rolling downhill. It's like a little snowball that picks up a mass as it keeps rolling down until it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And suddenly it's as if there's this mass conspiracy to trap the great free speech advocate. But I think it's a fiction in that sense. I don't think that and I think it was purposefully made into a fiction by Julian Assange. Now, we don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened between Assange and those two women.
Okay.
But I do know that he consciously made that a part of WikiLeaks. And then what something very interesting happens, which is if you want to be a supporter of Julian Assange, suddenly you have to be part and parcel of the vilification of these women. So we show the dark side of the internet in that regard, and we show some of these tweets that were directed at these women, one of which has a bullseye over one of the women's faces. It's pretty ugly stuff. And it's basically saying, you know, we're on your side, Julian, so we're going to go after these women big time.
Mm.
It's just the opposite of what you would think of as kind of liberating. You know, it comes from that place of anger, going back to that whole idea of crushing bastards. You know, maybe there's a variation here. But I think that it's a very disturbing part of the film where – and I also think, it made Julian Assange much more famous than he otherwise would have been because, you know, with our insatiable curiosity for all things sexual, I think the putting a sexual scandal in the middle of this and saying it was about the free speech agenda suddenly made him hugely famous in a way that otherwise wouldn't have been.
Here's another moment from the film. This is the Guardian investigative reporter Nick Davis again, talking about how these women who were making these charges got really ugly. They were vilified. From the film We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks.
There was an enormous amount of hype and misinformation that came out of Julian Assange's supporters. And the more that people realize that they were lied to by Julian, the less moral and political authority he has. He's supposed to be about truth.
You tried for months to get an on-camera interview with Julian Assange. And this is another turning point in the story. I mean, you ask him for the interview. You go to this, he's at this country estate in England to do these negotiations. 6 hours or something like that.
And 6 hours in a room. I would beg from time to time to be allowed to go to the bathroom. And then when I return, you know, Julian would continue the sentence he had already started just before I left.
Talk about that, because I have to say this is a very kind of interesting, in some ways disturbing part of the story. He wants money and he wants you to, ironically, so ironically, wants you to spy on some level on people.
He wants me to spy on all the other interview subjects. He wants intel on them. And if I provide him with intel, this is kind of like a spy's bargain, if I provide him with intel, then perhaps he will give me an interview. You know, if I'm not going to pay him, then I can pay him some other way, which is with this intel, to spy on these other interview subjects. I found that really not only ironic but appalling. I mean, for one who supposedly cares so much about source protection that he would think that I would betray all my sources to his benefit. You know, but I think it was his way of asking me, are you on my side or not? And if you're on my side, I want a show of proof that you are on my side. And if so, then perhaps we'll do an interview. I found it a very bizarre moment. But I found it also indicative of how Julian, over time, had decided that because his cause was good, he could do stuff that otherwise, you know, that he would find abhorrent in others, the ones that he was used to holding to account.
Mm-hmm.
And James Ball has a phrase for that in the film.
Yeah.
It's one that's often used by police departments, called noble cause corruption. The idea that because you're a good guy, you can do bad stuff and it's okay.
You know, the question comes up because he starts to sort of shed supporters, former colleagues of his. You mentioned James Ball, for example. Ball is very disturbed when Assange is asking some of his colleagues to sign these non-disclosure contracts, which, again, ironic for a man like Julian Assange. And so the question comes up is whether or not he himself has destroyed WikiLeaks and whether or not Julian Assange has really in some ways, by his own making in some way, been neutralized. What do you think now?
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
I mean, WikiLeaks will say that they're still publishing materials. They, you know, somebody hacked into Stratfor, the security firm, and got a bunch of emails, and WikiLeaks published them, and they recently published and categorized some, you know, some National Archives materials, which were public. So they'll say that they're still active, but I think they have, in fact, marginalized themselves, or Julian has marginalized himself. He had an opportunity, I think, to be a much more important figure than he is ending up becoming. And I think it's part and parcel of the reason for that has to do with, yes, the vicious attacks on him by the U.S. government, both publicly and also using their power to prevent money from going to WikiLeaks, which was kind of appalling. But I think in a way it was his inability to work with others. He doesn't play well with others, Julian. And I think that's cost WikiLeaks its importance. Now, it'll always have its importance in history.
Right.
There was a great moment there, but I think it's becoming increasingly irrelevant because Julian has marginalized himself. And the ultimate metaphor for that is the idea that he has now imprisoned himself in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Now, he'll say he had to do it because if he'd been extradited to Sweden, you know, as the British courts said he must to face those sex allegations, that the United States would have shipped him off to Gitmo, as his lawyer once said. But I found no proof for that either. So in terms of being marginalized, I mean, he has a platform. He has a computer. People still go to interview him in. He's constantly on television. But he still imprisoned himself in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
I want to ask you finally sort of get to a broader point here. And there's a question here from Marion in Salt Lake City I wanted to get to quickly because I think it gets to a bigger point. Marion, we don't have a lot of time, but welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
First of all, I think we have to stop complaining about no privacy because we gave up our privacy rights for Congress and President Bush with the Patriot Act. And spying is nothing new. If you go back to J. Edgar Hoover and you go back to McCarthy, none of this is new. I think we need to take a hard look at our own American society and what we expect and don't expect. Since 2003, we take off our shoes and belts at airports.
Yeah. Look, Mary, I'm going to put that to, forgive me, I'm going to put that to Alex Gibney because we're about out of time. But this bigger question that we are in this, in a new world now. I mean, James Ball sort of gets to this point that we're in this revolution about transparency and accountability and keeping power in check. And something has started and we're in a whole new world. What's your sort of final takeaway in some way from that?
Well, I think we see it now with the Snowden case. Here's yet another instance of this kind of asymmetric battle between very, very powerful forces of government and individuals who are upset that certain fundamental rights are being transgressed. So, you know, and in the computer age, suddenly striking back becomes far more possible. So it's a very interesting time we're living in.
Alex Gibney. His film is We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks. It's opening in Salt Lake City. You can check for that and details of where it might be in your area on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Alex Gibney, thanks again for the time.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.